Our final case today, which is case number 71182, First 100 LLC versus Mui. And we have Mr. Gutierrez and Mr. Stewart. And who joins you, Mr. Gutierrez?
John Lazer.
Okay. Just want to know. You guys get a break today. Because we have these students, what I ask you to do is, and you can turn around and face the students and turn your back to the Supreme Court for change. If you would just tell the students what this case is about, each of you.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Joseph Gutierrez. I'm counsel for the LLC. This case briefly is about two parties that had a contract for a purchase and sale of property. There was an arbitration provision in that initial contract. Subsequently, there was a settlement agreement that was made to the parties that did not have arbitration clause. So the main issue that we're dealing with is whether the subsequent agreement can, it doesn't have a arbitration clause and is silent on that issue, whether that carries into that agreement. It's our position that we moved to compel arbitration at the district court level. The court denied it, and we sought an appeal from that issue. So it's our position that the district court did not have jurisdiction to make any rulings because the case belongs to arbitration. And it was the other side that was going to raise that there would be merger clause and second agreement that actually subsumed the first arbitration clause. So therefore, there would be no arbitration case to come out of the district court. Another issue that has been raised by the respondents is that there was a waiver because we brought the motion to compel arbitration in response to a motion for summary judgment. That was on the outset of litigation. So the issue there is whether we waived our right, the person who waived his right to bring arbitration because they didn't bring it at the time of the end. So those are the primary issues on appeal in the case of Phillips v. Parker's 1990 case that says that you cannot draft a complaint that gets around the arbitration clause. That's sort of what we're arguing here in the expansion of that case. Those are the issues we bring in. Council address their side as well.
Thank you.
I think that was a pretty fair recitation. our position is that they waived it or seriously subsequent agreements have been quite bad. We find Phillips to be an opposite. They not comment about our argument stuff. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you both. And Mr. Gutierrez, you're ready to proceed.
Yes, sir.
And do you want to save any time? For rebuttal?
2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
And may it please the court. My name is Joseph Gutierrez. I'm counsel for First 100. The relief we're seeking, Your Honors, is an appeal from the district court's denial of First 100's motion to compel arbitration. And we're requesting that the court grant the appeal, reverse and remand the case back to the district court level to compel arbitration. The three main issues we framed them, Your Honor, is first, is the applicability of a merger clause and a subsequent agreement that is silent on arbitration. The second issue is whether a party can plead around an arbitration clause in drafting their complaint, yet still rely on the foundation of that contract in their claims. And the third issue is on waiver, whether a party waives its right to compel arbitration, and at what point does that waiver happen. So in addressing the first issue, Your Honor, on the...
Could I just ask, what happened after the district court denied arbitration? What occurred in the case?
After the district court denied arbitration, it had granted summary judgment as to liability. So in effect, it said there was a breach of the contract. Then there was a second motion for summary judgment on damages that was granted by the district court as well. So the case effectively was over at that point.
So when there was a denial of arbitration, was an appeal filed on that particular issue before the summary judgment was heard?
No, the appeal was filed. It was taken from the final judgments of the conclusion of the case once the entire award was
So you don't see any problem with jurisdiction as far as the failure to immediately file the appeal from the denial of arbitration?
I don't, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm asking you the same thing.
Yeah, so with the applicability of the merger clause, which is what the district court relied on in denying the motion to compel arbitration, it looked at the merger clause in the settlement agreement. And the settlement agreement was the third agreement between the parties. There was the purchase and sale agreement for property. There was a promissory note that encompassed the amount owed, and a settlement agreement to resolve the claims. However, in that settlement agreement, it's very key in that there's a section, section 16 of that agreement, that, first of all, the recitals incorporate both the promissory note and the purchase and sale agreement. They clearly incorporate those agreements into the settlement agreement. And in section 16 of that settlement agreement, it clearly states that it's entitled Background Provisions, and it says the provisions of section 1 above, the recitals, are incorporated into and made a substantive part of this agreement and are not mere recitals. So what we're saying in a settlement agreement is that the purchase and sale agreement that has the arbitration clause is incorporated into this document, and all the provisions are incorporated into this document. And they're not just recitals, they're not just background, it's the substantive part of that agreement is placed into the settlement agreement. Therefore, all the provisions in that agreement now apply in the settlement agreement. So the merger clause or integration clause doesn't subsume it and eliminate it. It actually incorporates it. And when you have something that's ambiguous, such as we have here, and you have an inconsistency, the law favors presuming arbitration and deferring to arbitration. And that's our position here, is that this wasn't a case where the arbitration clause was expressly revoked, or they address it and say, no, we're actually going to have this agreement be bound by the District Court of Nevada. It's an agreement where it's silent on it, but it subsumes the underlying agreement. So it's our position that the arbitration clause would then be bound by the parties if there was any dispute, which there was. So it's our position that because there was an ambiguous merger clause, that it does not apply. Secondly, the issue on whether a party can plead around an arbitration provision is one that was addressed by this court in the Phillips v. Parker case, which is a 1990 case. And what the court said in that case was, if you're going to rely substantively on a contract as the basis of your claims, you cannot plead around and pick and choose that you're now not relying on an actual arbitration clause. And that's what we have here. What they tried to do in this case was file only a complaint with only a breach of the settlement agreement and not the actual underlying purchase and sale agreement. And they try to artfully plead around this arbitration clause, and what we're asking the court to do is expand its holding on the Parker case that actually says you can, if you're going to rely in any way, shape, or form on a underlying contract with an arbitration clause, that you cannot then artfully draft a complaint to get out of that. And then the issue of waiver, Your Honor, I'd like to point out, first of all, it was never raised in the underlying district court proceeding. What was waived was the arguments that we've addressed on whether there was a merger doctrine or whether the settlement agreement had an arbitration clause. So, first of all, I don't think it's right to be addressed, but even if it is, the court's addressed what constitutes a waiver of an arbitration provision in the Nevada Gold case. And in that case, the court set out a three-part test as to when there's a waiver of arbitration. And the test is, one, that the party knew of its right to arbitrate, two, acted inconsistently with that right, and three, prejudiced the other party by the inconsistent acts. And I think that's the key. And all three have to be met for there to be an actual waiver. In that particular case, I believe there was 23 months of discovery that was done, several motions, dispositive issues. In this case, all that was done was an answer was filed. The case went forward there was a petition for exemption of arbitration in the non-binding program that was filed by the respondent. There was a motion for cost bond filed, out-of-state cost bond. There was a preemption of the judge. And then discovery was set to begin. When discovery begun, that's when summary judgment was filed by the respondents, and a counter motion to compel arbitration was filed. So it's our position that even though there may be knowledge of the arbitration clause, there was no prejudice to the respondents because there was no discovery done, there were no substantive issues decided. It was an issue that was filed immediately but upon discovery beginning, and therefore was right to be heard, and there was no waiver issue. In fact, there wasn't a waiver issue even discussed at the underlying level, so that was never brought before the district court. So, Your Honor, unless you have any specific questions, I think we're requesting that the appeal be granted and the case remanded to the district court with instructions to compel arbitration. We believe they did not have the court did not have jurisdiction to address any of the issues following that denial.
Well, what do you do with the motions for summary judgment that were granted?
The motion was granted at the same time as the motion to compel arbitration. I believe that the court didn't have jurisdiction to grant summary judgment.
So they'd be void ab initio?
Correct. Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Stuart. I had asked Mr. Gutierrez about jurisdiction as to
the nuts and bolts of when a motion for arbitration is granted or denied. You have 30 days to appeal. Do we have an issue here at all with that?
We may, Your Honor, although Tom Sawyer for the record on behalf of Rufino Louie. May it please the court. We may have an NRAP 3A question, although one sort of wrinkle is that this was an opposition and counter motion, opposition to a motion for summary judgment as to liability and counter motion for arbitration. The motion for summary judgment was granted first, and then the order denying a counter motion was granted second. So I think in the interest of finality, I suppose our position is that if you don't want to entertain the appeal, that's fine too. But I suppose in the interest of finality, this may be a final order under NRAP 3A.
And I usually don't like to talk about public policy, but what my colleagues and I have seen, whether it be from the United States Supreme Court and the Federal Arbitration Act or just the arbitration clauses, it seems like the courts are favoring arbitration from a public policy standpoint of view. What do you say about that, this particular case?
I would slightly disagree with that, Your Honor. And I would say that irrespective of whether they favor arbitration or not, the push seems to be to treat arbitration clauses as though they are any other contract clause. The Federal Arbitration Act, in the cases from the U.S. Supreme Court, AT&T, Kindred, Nursing Homes, and their progeny, and the cases from this court interpreting those, say that if arbitration clauses are in a contract, they're to be treated just like any other clause in the contract. And for that reason, Your Honor, we are asking that this court treat the terms of the settlement agreement as a contract in the four corners of the settlement agreement. I think an important note here is that the word arbitration is not found in the settlement agreement. It's five pages, it's a record 40 to 44, it's 19 sections. The word arbitration is not included.
What about the integration clause?
The integration clause says that all prior agreements are merged into this one. And we would contrast that with the applicable law section, which is section 9 of the contract, which provides that the parties, this agreement is intended to be enforced according to its written terms. Venue for any legal action concerning this agreement shall lie exclusively in Clark County, Nevada, and the parties consent to jurisdiction and venue in such court. It's our position that that supersedes any prior superseded arbitration clause. And I think I know the court is aware of the facts, but a brief recitation might be helpful here.
Please do.
There's a purchase and sale agreement in 2014 between First 100 and my client. Importantly, Section 3.3 is an arbitration clause, but Section 1.6 says, if quiet title cannot occur in 90 days, then my client can take purchase price plus 10%, some certain. 90 days goes by, no quiet title, my client says, I'd like the 10%, the some certain. The parties enter into a promissory note. That's at record 58 through 60. The promissory note says the First 100 is going to pay my client by December, some certain. It also says at record at 59 that any disputes involving non-payment of this note are to be settled with exclusive jurisdiction in the district court. December comes, December goes, no payment. We reach out, instead of initiating action, we settle. Sign a settlement agreement, includes some 19-odd provisions, including that my client is to be paid within 30 days of the settlement agreement, and that any disputes are to be settled in the district court. My friend on the other side mentions the recitals. The recital 1.5 says that this is a dispute involving non-payment of the note. And again, any dispute of the note, exclusive jurisdiction in the district court. So we go through, 30 days goes, no payment. We send notice. Within 3 days, if the breach of the settlement agreement is not cured,
We're going to file suit. No cure. Complaint is initiated. The complaint is a 2-7 of the record, and the general allegations mention the purchase and sale agreement. They mention the note, and then they arrive at the causes of action. It's the breach of the settlement agreement, breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and unjust enrichment. So, irrespective of the analysis under Phillips, this was not a situation where we pled around or we carefully tried to avoid a purchase and sale agreement or an arbitration clause. There's no arbitration clause. There's nothing to get around. The settlement agreement said 30 days, payment is due, any dispute goes to the district court. 30 days lapsed, we brought the dispute in the district court. Excuse me. And appellant's theory that somehow the rights of the settlement agreement are tethered to or derived from a twice superseded, twice breached agreement goes against fundamental notions of contract law. The rights of a contract are vested upon the meeting of the minds when you have an offer, acceptance, and consideration. That's a restatement one of contracts. So it is not silent on the issue, but rather it supersedes the issue and is a standalone contract unto itself.
Mr. Stewart, when you talk about the definitive, if it's not paid within 30 days, it's going to Clark County District Court, what are you referring to?
In which agreement, Your Honor?
I'm looking at the settlement agreement, which these claims appear to arise from the settlement agreement rather than the purchase agreement.
So I would agree. The settlement amount and payment are at sections 2.1 and 2.2. That is sort of the bottom of 40 and the top of 41.
I got that here.
And then applicable law would be section 9, which is at 42 of the record.
Well, it says this is to be enforced in the case of Nevada.
The last
venue in Clark County.
And consent to jurisdiction. And if I may, perhaps I misspoke, the more definitive is in the promissory note, and that's at 59 of the record, exclusive jurisdiction. The waiver issue, okay, and so,
I don't want to slow your roll here, but we're to construe arbitration agreements very generously. So here you have a pretty unambiguous arbitration agreement and the purchase agreement.
Agreed.
Settlement agreement is a little, it incorporates the purchase agreement, and it's a little, the language is a little softer. It talks about where things should happen or whatnot. I mean, why shouldn't we be construing the settlement agreement to bring forward the arbitration agreement?
2 points on that, Your Honor. First, is a little more pedantic.
Sure.
The issue of ambiguity wasn't raised at the district court level, so there was no finding that this was ambiguous, mm-hmm. and I think as the appellant, they failed to meet the burden showing that issue is preserved. Maybe more specifically, the settlement agreement, by its own terms, is reached in settlement of a dispute over the note, not the purchase and sale agreement. The note has an unequivocal choice of law provision, venue provision. So it references directly the note, 1.5. It does not reference directly the purchase and sale agreement. Purchase and sale agreement is for the purchase of real property, whereas the note is an agreement for them, for First 100, to pay Ms. Louie. Mm-hmm. Further, the court typically looks to the four corners of the agreement to discern the intent of the parties. Without a finding of ambiguity, typically the court is not to look at extrinsic or parallel evidence. Mm-hmm. If that were the case, if the court found ambiguity, then they would look outside the four corners to discern the intent of the parties, which I think is intertwined with the waiver issue. The test for waiver asks whether the non-waiving party, this supposedly waiving party, has acted inconsistently with their right to arbitrate. In 2014, and we submit the First 100 has, in 2014 they entered into a purchase and sale agreement that said there was an arbitration clause. When a dispute arose over that, it didn't arbitrate. It signed a note that acknowledged they were going to pay Ms. Louie. When a dispute arose over that, they did not seek to arbitrate through the purchase and sale agreement. Rather, they settled, which is the finding that the district court made at the hearing on the motion.
Well, settling in is not inconsistent with an arbitration agreement.
Not entirely inconsistent, okay. But when taken with the sum of their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Further, when suit was filed, we alleged a breach of the settlement agreement. They in their answer, did not plead arbitration as an affirmative defense and thus waived it under NRCP 8C. Further, into the litigation, Ms. Louis filed an exemption from court-annexed arbitration. The Nevada Rules of Alternative Dispute Resolution provide 5 days to object. No objection was filed, and thus, pursuant to those rules, Rule 5B, they've waived that. The commissioner exempted the file, or a month later, the commissioner exempted the case from court-annexed arbitration. Mm-hmm. Again, the rules provide 5 days to object or waive the claim. No objection was made. They waived, again, their claim of arbitration. It was not until they opposed the motion for summary judgment as to liability that they presented this theory of derivative rights from an agreement from years ago.
Is there any argument that we should construe this agreement, this settlement agreement, against your client since your firm drafted it?
There's not, Your Honor. In the applicable law section, it says that both parties were allowed a chance to review and have counsel review it, and that as a result, it should not be construed against the drafter.
And what about the issue of who decides motions for summary judgment? It seems Mr. Gutierrez is saying that if, in fact, we agree with him, that the issues of summary judgment should be by the arbitrator. Why isn't it by the district judge who's hearing the case? How do we decide who decides dispositive motions in an arbitration situation like this? This is very confusing to me.
I believe the district court would retain the ability to decide dispositive motions. However, I think First 100's position is that they should have never been allowed to get that far prior to an arbitrator sort of having a first look and ordering discovery. I believe the district court would retain that ability.
But in all arbitration cases, isn't that an issue as to actually who decides dispositive motions? Where is it in either agreement as to who decides dispositive motions?
Well, the district court retains the ability to determine whether something should go to arbitration. The arbitratability of an issue is something vested in the district court.
But arbitration is a trial. Summary judgment is not a trial. I mean, I'm arguing with you, and it's to your benefit if you go with me on this. If I go with you on this after I've told you how to do it, you know.
Certainly. Well, I believe that the district court would certainly retain the ability.
But where is it in either agreement or any case law as to who makes it a trial? We've had this issue before, our colleagues before, as to who gets to determine. Even if it's an arbitration case, who determines something like summary judgment? What stops you from going to the district court judge to say there's no material issue of fact here?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Yeah. It's an interesting concept. I'll ask Mr. Gutierrez on his rebuttal.
Okay.
Go ahead with your argument. I'm sorry.
That's okay. And the final, so waiver asks whether the party is aware of their right to arbitrate. We submit they've been aware since 2014. It asks whether they've acted inconsistently with their right to arbitrate. We submit they've acted that way since 2014. And the final prong of the analysis is prejudice. And prejudice can be shown by a significant duplication of efforts. And at this point, there's nothing left to do. There was summary judgment as to liability, or summary judgment as to damages, attorney fees and costs. There's no dispute as to liability. Taken outside of a legal context, the contract clearly provided that payment was to be made within 30 days, and the payment didn't occur.
So the message that we'd be sending if we find that there was a waiver is that if there's an arbitration clause in an agreement, don't litigate. As soon as you got that arbitration clause, make sure you file your motion to compel arbitration rather than do anything else. Is that the message we should take to the bar here?
I think the message is that if you intend to arbitrate, you should act promptly. If you are aware of your right, if it's not buried somewhere in some thousand-page contract, you should move promptly. And I don't think that would be announced in this case. I think that the current three-part test rewards folks who arbitrate promptly. They don't wait until the end of a case to try to get another bite at the apple. It's our position that they've had multiple bites at the apple, and only when they were close to the core did they move to compel arbitration. So if there are any other questions, I would. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gutierrez, what about that issue as to who decides motions for summary judgment when there's an arbitration clause in the original agreement?
Yes, and Your Honor, that, I think that issue can be addressed in Section 3.3, which is the arbitration provision of the purchase and sale agreement. It says clearly the arbitrator shall make findings of fact and law in writing to support his decision and shall award reimbursement of attorney fees and costs of the arbitration to the prevailing party as the arbitrator deems appropriate. Because this is a binding arbitration agreement, the arbitrator is not only going to hear the trial, but hear all dispositive motions. If this was in the court annex arbitration program and non-binding, the district court would retain that jurisdiction. So the only jurisdiction the district court, I believe, in this case would retain under this arbitration clause is to enter the final judgment.
But what to Mr. Stewart's argument that these claims are arising out of the settlement agreement and not out of the purchase agreement?
Yeah, that's how they pled it, that they're arising out of the settlement agreement. But the settlement agreement.
Do you dispute that? The claims themselves that are at issue here are arising out of the settlement agreement?
Absolutely, because of how they pled their summary judgment motion. It heavily relied on both. All three agreements. It wasn't just this is a breach of the settlement agreement. It encompassed the purchase and sale agreement, the history between the parties. It had the deed. It had the transfer of the note. It had everything in there. So what they're saying is we want our complaint to focus on this small issue, but when we move for summary judgment, we're encompassing everything. And at that point is when, you know, we look at all three agreements, and the arbitration clause that was in the original one was never expressly revoked in the other two. So
does it have to be expressly revoked, or does it have to be expressly invoked?
That's a great question. That's something that I think it goes to one of your other prior questions as to what the FAA discusses regarding preference as to arbitration. It says any doubts concerning the scope of arbitrable issues should be resolved in favor of arbitration. I think if we're going to take that another step, that if you're going to have a second agreement or a subsequent agreement, it should expressly revoke that arbitration clause, because if it's silent and it leaves any ambiguity, then I believe that the arbitration clause will still be valid.
Why wasn't this pled as an affirmative defense?
There was an affirmative defense pled as to jurisdiction and venue. It wasn't pled specifically as to as to this belongs in arbitration. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is looking at the face of the complaint and how they artfully pled it, which was based solely on the settlement agreement. But when it comes down to what their relief was being sought in the summary judgment context and what evidence they were trying to set forth to establish their claims, it was clear that it was an issue like we have in Phillips. It was a lot larger than what was initially pled. So, and going to the arbitration petition for exemption from arbitration, I mean, that is something that's filed with the Nevada Arbitration Commissioner. That's not an issue that a motion to compel arbitration would be filed with. So I don't believe there's a waiver.
But when you objected, or when there was an objection to it going to that, I mean, isn't each time arbitration comes up an opportunity for First 100 to say, hey, we're supposed to arbitrate, but just not here?
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with Your Honor on that. Absolutely. And I think the issue was, is this case worth more than $50,000? That's why they filed a petition for exemption. We had no disagreement that the case wasn't worth more than $50,000, so we weren't going to oppose it on that issue. Was that a time to raise arbitration? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So was the filing of the answer. But it was raised as soon as discovery opened and there was a filing of a substantive issue such as summary judgment. Mm-hmm. We didn't wait till summary judgment was decided and say, I don't like how you ruled, Judge Israel. We're now going to file arbitration. There was no issues being decided. It was filed as a counter motion to summary judgment because we believe that the court had no jurisdiction to decide that issue. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Court thanks both attorneys for their arguments in this matter. An interesting case for us and hopefully for the students on issue arbitration. It's become a very big deal to my colleagues. We have many, many issues as to whether a motion to compel arbitration should be granted or denied. So we're seeing a lot of it, and the federal government has had some major, the United States Supreme Court has had some major cases on this. So this